Welcome back to the UX Whisperers podcast. We are here to dive into the world of UX research and usability testing. Today, we are excited to have a special guest with us, Eniola Abioye. Born and raised in Oakland, California, Eniola is a lead UX researcher at Meta and the founder of UX Out Loud, a career coaching and consulting business for user experience research. At Meta, she conducts research and builds strategies in business messaging. Outside of work, Eniola is a thought leader, content creator, and subject matter expert in user experience research and career development. I am Sarita Safon, principal UX researcher at Userlytics, and I'm thrilled to have Eniola on the show to share her insights and experiences. So welcome, Eniola.
Thank you. So excited to be here.
And Eniola, to start, we have talked a little bit about what you do currently, but tell us about your background and how you got into UX research, what it's like working for a global tech company like Meta.
Sure. So I have been in UX research about 10 years now. My background is in integrative biology. That's what I studied in undergrad. And growing up and throughout college, I knew I was really, really interested in science and systems and kind of like figuring out puzzles and problem solving. And I've always been big on people. I've always liked talking to people, working with people. And so I just thought that the only way to merge those things was to go into medicine, because that's what I heard growing up. And in college, I figured out I didn't want to be a doctor. I was pre-med throughout college, but then I figured out after like shadowing and talking to doctors that that's not what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so after school, I was just looking for a job, and I had this bio degree and didn't necessarily know what I wanted to do with it. And my first job was at a market research and user research firm that worked specifically in biotech. So that was the connection for me. I didn't really know user research was a thing in college. I didn't picture myself in a design career at all. I'm not really design oriented. And I didn't understand how much intention went into building out products. But I've grown up in the Bay Area. I've been around Silicon Valley and around tech. And so I understood that it was a big deal. I just didn't know that there was a place for what I wanted to do within it. And so I landed my first job. I was doing so many projects because I was agency side. And I was working with all the big biotech firms to really understand like how they were serving their patients. And I was talking to patients and doctors and understanding how different therapy areas or different disease areas and different therapies were received by patients. And so I feel like once I learned how to moderate and started conducting my first studies and leading my first studies, I just knew that this was it for me.
you just feel it, no?
Yeah, I was like, oh, this is it. I could do this. And so that was how I got started. From there, I moved on to working in human-centered design at Kaiser, which was really fun. Okay. From there, I shifted things a bit and moved on to Silicon Valley Bank, went into fintech. And now, like you mentioned, I'm at Meta and I work in business messaging. So the conversations that happen between consumers and businesses on platforms, Messenger, Instagram, WhatsApp, and that's been a blast too. I think over the course of my career, I've had one of my favorite things has been having conversations with consumers and with advertisers, but across the board, I've had really intimate conversations, right? And just enjoyed holding space for people to share what their experiences have been and where they've fallen short and what they've really enjoyed. When it came to talking to founders at Silicon Valley Bank, the conversations around money in a banking relationship, especially as you're growing a company, were really intimate, similar to like the conversations I was having at Branding Science, where I started out about different disease areas and how, having a disease and navigating life with a disease had impact. So that's kind of been a trend across my career.
So you as a UX researcher, what would you say is the biggest challenge that we face?
So I think right now the challenge that's most top of mind for me in my work is collaboration, right? Which also happens to be one of the most important things in our work as UX researchers, because there are so many different elements of building product, and there's so many people in the kitchen, right? Which is a great thing, because product teams should have a bunch of different toolboxes and a bunch of different skill sets in the mix. But when you are working with multiple people, you're working with different objectives, right? Mm-hmm. And so as a product team, like our job is really to align on what objectives are we focusing on now, and like, what is our concerted effort in order to get there? And also within that, you have people who are wearing different hats, right? You have your data scientists, you have your product managers, you have your user researchers, you have your content designers, you have your product designers. And so within that, with so many cooks in the kitchen, everyone has a job to do, right? And everyone has a focus and a toolbox that their frame of reference is within. And so pulling so many people onto the same like line of thought or onto the same objective over and over again, or like consistently rather, mm-hmm. Is a challenge, but it's also one of the like beautiful things about working in product. But as you know, working as a UX researcher, it takes a lot of effort. I think mm-hmm. collaboration is one of them. The other biggest challenge, which is also one of the most important things that I'm seeing as a researcher, is making sure that we're aligned with the business at mm-hmm. all times. So that means understanding the business of what we do. Like I tell researchers and designers, like it's important to understand how the product that you're working on makes money, because that's not kind of like antithetical to mm-hmm. user research or to building user-centered product, but it's really like important to understand how the company objectives align with our objectives and how company priorities reflect in our priorities. And so those are the two top of mind things that I'm sharing with a lot of like user researchers in the mm-hmm. field right now, because there's a lot of focus on them.
Okay.
And they also happen to be challenging.
So while you talk about this, it comes to my mind, the self-referential design and how personal preferences might impact UX outcomes. What is your view on this?
Yeah, so I think as a UX researcher, one of the things that really drew me to working in the space, especially with consumers, is that I can really identify with the consumers that I'm serving, right? When I moved to Meta, I was thinking, wow, there are so many people who use these platforms mm-hmm. and wear different hats on the platforms. And so it's really easy to kind of identify and have empathy with the jobs to be done that people have to do on the platforms. But also, like you mentioned, with design, it can be really easy to think about, you know, your use cases or your jobs to be done on a platform and think, well, what would I want to do? And this might be what other users want to do. But there are just so many different cultural contexts. There are so many different tasks or jobs to be done that people have on the platform. There are so many different types of people who are using it, right? Mm-hmm. And like personalities and like how people want to connect and how people prefer to access their information. And so it's just so important to not assume that people think like me or move like me. And I think working on a platform that is used by so many people, like it really does cause you to step back and say, okay, I can't make assumptions about what people would want. I have to base the decisions that and the recommendations that I'm giving to my product team on evidence. So what is the evidence that I am presenting or that I can pull, right? So that's where working with my like content person and my data scientists, like to produce that evidence so that I even hold myself accountable to the recommendations that I make or the decisions that I make as a researcher need to be based in evidence. And that evidence needs to show up quantitatively and qualitatively. So I think the way to mitigate the bias, my own bias and the bias of the people on my team, is to pull data and to pull evidence and then base our decisions in that.
Would you have any other recommendation of strategies that you use to ensure that the designs reflect really the needs of the user rather than not only the researcher preferences, but also the designer's references?
So I've been in a lot of like working environments where we're in an agile framework. So mm-hmm. being able to test and bring users in and get user opinions as early and often as possible has been like my anchor point to avoid kind of the bias of designing for myself rather than designing mm-hmm. for the users that we're targeting. So being able to do a lot of iterative research, doing a lot of like testing the platform with different members of the team has been really helpful. But getting people's eyes on it and people like touching and feeling and like playing around with a thing as often as possible has been really helpful.
Okay. And precisely, you were mentioning that you work for a product that is aimed to global audiences, including cultures, different cultures and different people from different cultures. Why is it important to consider cultural diversity in UX research and design?
Yeah, so when we're conducting research and designing products for people to use, people are just so different, right? People are coming in from different contexts. And when we look at the core values of human-centered design or user centricity, one of those elements is think of everything as a system, right? So no matter what it is that you're designing, people are not using the product in a silo, right? It's not the only part of their day. It's not the only part of their work. Typically, they're using your product, you know, in conjunction with something else, or, you know, they have things to think about or considerations, or they have an entire experience, right? So when we think about the products that we're designing, we're not just thinking about this one interaction, we're thinking about how it's interconnected to all the other interactions that they're having throughout their day. So there's so much to take into account. And the more that we talk to people and understand like the context that they're bringing to using the product and like what it looks like, or what their overall kind of like jobs to be done looks like, the more we see how interconnected everything is. So I think as we, as designers and researchers, when we're looking at product development or when we're looking at building experiences out for people, we have to understand as holistically as possible what their experience looks like. And so that's where like journey mapping comes to into account and like understanding step by step, okay, what are they doing and what are the opportunities for delight in their day? How do we compare to other, you know, elements of their work or other tools that they're using? And how can we make things as like seamless as possible experience to experience, even though we're only one part of it?
And could you share maybe an instance in your experience where a cultural misunderstanding led to a product redesign or where biases were successfully mitigated?
Yeah. Okay. So I'll shout out a couple. One, back when I was working at Branding Science, I did a bit of device testing. Mm-hmm. And so we were testing devices in multiple markets, right? I was in APAC, I was in the US. And so I was trying to understand how people felt about using a device and was it intuitive and was it clear across multiple cultural context, right? So when I say culture, I'm thinking not just how people approach a different like therapy area, but also things like stigma and what that looks like. And also like what people are familiar with as far as mental model. So like other tools that are similar, do the colors resonate? Do where the button is resonate? Do like the instructions and things and the copy that are in the instructions resonate? And is it familiar according to people's mental model and trying to build a consistent product across multiple mental models is really difficult. And so that took a lot of testing and a lot of really close collaboration with our content designer to make sure things were as transferable as possible.
Of course.
So that's one example. Another example of cultural context would be so like right now I work in business messaging, and so how people communicate is super important, and it differs everywhere, right? Yes. And it differs by, you know, type of user to a different market. And so taking that into account when we look at platforms or how they work or the features that are built out on platforms and where they're enabled comes to play.
Okay. And we have talked about different forms of biases in this conversation. And perhaps it's a good reminder for our audiences that the European Accessibility Act will come in effect next year in 2025. In simple terms, the EAA goal is to make sure that companies that sell products or services in the European market consider accessibility in their offerings. How do you go about making sure that accessibility bias gets mitigated as much as possible?
So when it comes to accessibility, like you said, it comes down a lot to bias, right? The people who are designing the product and in charge of like shipping the product aren't privy to the different ways that people navigate accessibility needs when it comes to managing the product, it's really easy to build it within just the frame of reference of, okay, most people will interact with this product how I do, right? Mm-hmm. So when we think about user research and the strategy behind it, as far as user segmentation, not talking to just the people who are kind of at the center of how we expect people to use it and like the type of user segment we expect to see mostly on the platform, but also incorporating the people in user segments or in groups that we see less on the platform, but that we see, right? Or that we want to target or want to make the tool inclusive for, is super important. So when we think about recruiting for a study, for example, I think about, okay, who are we targeting or who is most often using this or who is most often having the experience where this tool would be valuable and talk in recruiting them, but also making sure that I'm recruiting segments that are differentiated, right? Mm-hmm. So if I see most people using this are in a certain age group, I'm going to recruit on both sides of the age group as well. If I see that it typically people have a certain type of job or level of tech savviness, I'm going to recruit on either side of that to make sure, or in different job categories as well, to make sure that I'm hearing from people who are not just in the center of the users that I'm thinking about. So I'm not just designing for users who are at the mm-hmm. center. So as many kind of like I break down the elements of the experience or the element of the demographics and infographics that I incorporate into the sample, and then making sure that I'm differentiating at every characteristic.
Oh, that's an interesting strategy. I actually haven't heard that before. And actually, now that you mentioned that, I recently read in a study survey that highlighted the reasons why UX research studies failed. And one of the main reasons was bad participant recruitment, meaning that the insights generated from the study came from the wrong people. But in your experience, what has been the main roadblocks to designing great products for large audiences, other than all of the aspects that we've discussed before?
Yeah. So something that I've seen in my past 10 years in user research is the delineation between product strategy conversations and product design conversations. When we think about product design and CAPD, we think about conversations that are related to the design, to the research, or to the copy of a product. And then when we think product strategy, we typically think, you know, product managers are running conversations with engineers, with data scientists, and the like. And so like having those as siloed conversations, I've seen that kind of slow down product design or make product design a bit more difficult. When really, when we're having the like high level product conversations as far as strategy and objectives and setting priorities, those are conversations that designers, researchers, content designers have to participate in, because at the end of the day, we're all product strategists. Mm-hmm. Across the board, no matter what kind of, you know, role we're in or what title we have, we're product strategists, and we all have the same goal of moving product forward, whether, you know, what by whatever metrics you can think of, right? Mm-hmm. By revenue, by usage, by value we're delivering to our users. And so rather than kind of delineate the, like, you know, product design from our core strategy and like, you know, raising, you know, revenue and what we're targeting and things like that being separate conversations, they're all the same conversation. And I think design, like CAPD design, you know, researchers, content strategists, not being a part of some of the high level product strategy conversations really sets mm-hmm. us back as far as time and cohesiveness that we can have as product teams. Mm-hmm. And so I would like to see that more. And I advise researchers that I work with, all of those conversations are a space for you to be in and to bring in your product strategy expertise. The thing that makes us researchers versus designers versus data scientists are what's in our toolbox, right? Or mm-hmm. what we specialize in. But at the end of the day, we all have the same goal of adding to the product strategy conversation. And so participating in those conversations. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning of my career, you know, when a conversation was really around, you know, objectives and didn't really mention the design or didn't mention any like types of products or opportunities for research, I kind of checked out. Mm-hmm. And I'm realizing now that that's one of the most important spaces for me to be checked in and for me to share my recommendations around product strategy.
Okay. And once you have the results in, how do you ensure you gather the right insights from the right people before rolling out features or products?
So based, when you say the right people, do you mean my sample or do you mean product team?
Yeah, the sample, the recruitment that you do for the study.
So I specialize in qualitative research. And so typically my sample sizes are smaller than you would expect for like a quantitative research project. But I'm looking at multiple segments when I do, right? So beforehand, before I do any research project, one, I'm looking at secondary research first. So I'm doing my literature review and understanding, okay, what do we know already and what can I take into this project? Because it's not about just learning as much as possible or like diving into as much content as possible, but like making it as streamlined as possible for me. So I'm doing literature review first, and then I'm always meeting with my data scientist to understand what story are the numbers telling us already, right? And what am I looking specifically to kind of validate, or what am I looking to dive deeper into based on what we know already numbers wise? And then from there, I can kind of piece into the user types or the kind of like segments or like demographic information that's playing into where I'm trying to find more information. And then from there, like I said earlier, I'm looking at the different demographics that we that point to the people who are most likely to use the product, but also the different experiences. So when I'm screening, I'm not just looking at like, hey, you know, where's this person based and kind of age and things like that. I'm also asking them kind of what's your comfort with technology and what are some of your core jobs to be done and things like that, to understand not just their demographics, but their behaviors that's indicating what I'm, the information I'm trying to get. And then looking, choosing the different kind of spectrums of activity that I'm most interested in and making sure that I'm talking to people at different points in that spectrum. So I'm trying to get as much knowledge as I can in these like usually deep engagements, right? Because I'm qualitative. So IDIs, usability tests, things like that. And making sure that I am talking to a breadth of people so that I can get a breadth of perspective. Because at the end of the day, I have to come and bring those perspectives and turn them into insights. And then from there, I'm working with my product team to really dive into, okay, what are the opportunities based on this information that we know, and really co-creating the like next steps based on my recommendations and insights.
Okay. And I wanted to dig a little bit deeper in that piece where you actually gather this qualitative information, because I would guess that even in a small sample, you get a lot of information. How do you work to mitigate the different biases that we have talked about during that analysis and results and reporting part?
So typically at the end of the study, when I have gathered all of my information, I look at that and then I go into my data analysis, right? And different types of projects call for different data analysis methods, but typically I'll start with like thematic data analysis. So bucketing the data that comes back and like revisiting the core questions and intended impact that I had at the beginning of the study, and then looking at what the answers I'm receiving to those questions. In that process for me, it's not just me who's hearing the feedback, right? So like this comes back down to like how UX research is a team sport. I lead projects and I also have a team of researchers that we're constantly talking about and kind of brainstorming and thinking through what insights we're getting back and how it relates to not just our team, but the teams that are around us in our organization. And this, it's been this way kind of throughout my career where I'm not just the only researcher on a team. And so being able to like thought partner with other researchers and other designers and kind of think through, okay, what did we hear and what came through? And what are some like areas that we want to like dive deeper into based on what we're hearing? Because there's always surprises or there's always really interesting tidbits that come through. And so being able to like sit down and thought partner with other people who understand the goals of the project and what our objectives were and understand the information that came through is super helpful for me, because I always say I think best out loud. Like I love just being able to throw ideas on a whiteboard and like throw different buckets and understand like what it is that we're hearing and like brainstorm with people about what we can do to turn the insights that we're getting into impact. So I would say a great way to mitigate bias in data analysis is to not do it by yourself and to not keep that brainstorming process in your head.
Okay. And once you present these insights to the rest of the team, how do you see the influence in the design decisions that are taking after that?
So that process of like seeing your impact play out can vary based on the product and based on the process that you go through, based on the methods that you use. But as researchers, it really is our job to track the progress of the insights, even if it takes 6 months or a year or 2 years. And so I look back to the metrics that we aligned on for the first at the beginning of any product, right? When I'm scoping a project before building out a research plan or choosing a method, in that scoping process is understanding kind of what our core questions are, what's our timeline, what are our objectives, what are our hypotheses that are already on the team. And so I always have that documentation to true back to as far as, okay, based on the questions that we set forth to answer, what are we hearing so far? But also, what are the metrics that matter? What are the metrics that we are aligned on, being our priority to move or shift? And so, based on those metrics, I can team up with my data scientist to kind of check in on what the metrics look like, because those are the ones that the team has already identified that matter the most to shift in this moment. And so, in order to track the impact over time and see how designs are affecting the product or moving it forward, I look back to those same metrics.
And how have you ever experienced a situation where you have to handle a project that involves a certain bias, like for example, accessibility in specific, where it is deeply embedded in the user data that you collect?
In the beginning of my career, when I was working in biotech and working with vulnerable populations across different disease areas, it was all about accessibility. So, like, my orientation to UX research and my frame of reference is all around having intimate conversations, being super intentional about the conversations I'm having, right? Because they were monitored and tracked, and I was ready for things to come up in conversation that potentially needed to be reported and things like that. So accessibility and understanding how people behave and how different behaviors made space for certain therapies. Because it wasn't just about, designing a good thing that worked. It was designing a thing that was intuitive and valuable enough and easy enough to use, so that it would be used. Right? Because when something is, I think, at the core of like my research practice, like if something isn't being used, then there's an issue in the design, right? Not with the user, right? We
Of
can't say,
course.
like, hey, we built this really good thing, it works so well, you should be using it, right? Or you should change your behavior to around this thing that we've built. It's really, really, really hard to change behavior. It's extremely hard to like to approach design with a mindset of I'm going to build this thing and then I'm going to make people understand how great it is and that they should use it. But instead, understanding what people's journeys look like and how people behave, and then building something that's in alignment with that is going to be much, much easier on the back end.
Definitely. And on a personal level, what has been your biggest challenge when designing for accessibility, and how did you overcome it?
I think the challenge for me in kind of contributing to design around accessibility is always checking my biases, because we all have them, right? And especially around accessibilities, our frame of reference is our own abilities and how we lead our own lives and like our personal preferences and things like that. So like you said, kind of checking that at the door. And being able to like incorporate kind of your own experience and your own perspective, but not leave it there. And take the step forward of like, or take it to the next level of incorporating other people's perspectives into what you're building and building alongside other people so that they're, if you miss something or if a point of bias shows up for you, hopefully. Because you're working on a team of other CapD folks and product folks, that other people catch it or other people call out based on their perspectives, some opportunities to be more inclusive and more accessible.
And we've talked about the past and the present, but I wanted to focus also a little bit on the future. How do you think AI is changing the UX research and design industries?
I am a researcher that's really excited about AI. And when we think about AI, I've heard people kind of talk about it as this very like far away futuristic thing. But in reality, AI and machine learning has been around for a really long time. And so the ways that we leverage it to make user research more accessible and easier to do and easier to do on a consistent basis are really exciting. When it comes to data analysis, especially like aggregating insights from really large data sets looking through like really long transcripts has been really helpful for me because that part of, you know, conducting all the research, once research is conducted and field work is done, people want insights right away if possible, right? So like not having to do it all manually because I don't, you know, take notes during my sessions. I'm only focused on moderating. And so I depend on AI tools to go back and like, you know, track through the things that I heard really quickly and be able to surface the insights as quickly as possible. Because in this market too, we know that a lot of UX researchers are spread really thin. So these AI tools that allow us to do things more efficiently or more quickly have like made a really big difference in the amount of projects I'm able to take on or the amount of teams I'm able to support. I think there's been a lot of conversation around like, can AI do what user research does? And is this field going to slowly disappear as AI is here? And I have used and seen a lot of AI tools. I haven't seen any that even come close to being able to participate in product strategy in the ways that user researchers do. I think when people bring up the conversation of, is AI going to replace user research? I think they're thinking about a very small piece of what user researchers do and not thinking about us in the totality of being a product strategy partner and bringing in user evidence and bringing in what we know in order to like apply to product, right? I think they think about, okay, well, facilitating a study and sharing the insights, right? But that's really like 20% at most of what it is that we do. And so as far as like the AI conversation, I think the developing tools to be able to do what we do more efficiently and like save as much of our energy for strategy rather than kind of like the logistics and like operations around your research is really exciting.
Definitely. I completely agree with you that we have to see AI more as a research partner than as a researcher substitute. But what could you see as maybe disadvantages of using AI inside UX research?
So the one thing I will say is that as more research tools have come on the market and made research more accessible, which I think is fantastic, we're seeing more and more people who are not researchers doing research. And I am a big fan of democratizing user centricity. I'm a big fan of, you know, designing for the user is not only the researchers and only the product designer's responsibility. And also user research is a skill, right? There's a lot of intentionality that goes into good research. There's a lot of rigor that goes into good research and good sampling and, you know, responsible insights and recommendations that take into account both what the team is trying to achieve and what the user experience we're trying to build is. There's a lot of focus and intentionality that goes into user research. And so as I see more tools coming onto the market, some leverage AI, most leverage AI in some way, some don't. But as I see more tools, I'm seeing more people conduct research, you know, based on what they see, right? I need some questions. I need to have conversations with someone who uses the product or who might use the product. And that's about it. And that's not it. And so what I'll say is that there is still a responsibility to conduct really good research, especially when you're conducting research that is client or customer facing. And the rigor with which you use in research design directly reflects on the quality of the insights that you're going to get back. And so I'm seeing a lot of people, you know, based on what they see, think research is pretty simple and straightforward. Mm-hmm. And it can be, but I will say there's a lot of rigor and intentionality that goes into UX research to get good results that you can use use efficiently and also have high confidence in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think as we kind of democratize people doing research, we need to like help them really understand what goes into research and how we do it.
Precisely. What would you recommend these teams that are do not have a research team or do not have researchers at hand, but use these AI tools in order to at least approach UX research?
Yeah. So I totally understand that some teams or organizations aren't ready to invest in a research team or even their first researcher just yet. And so I'm not saying that they shouldn't utilize these tools. I'm just saying that along with the access to the tools needs to come education, even if it's just the basics, right? Even if it's free courses on LinkedIn or on YouTube, but like understanding the basics of human-centered design and like the elements that we're looking to drive and like how to create personas and how to understand user journeys and the basics of service design. And like how we approach sampling, whether, you know, qualitative or quantitatively, like there's just so much content. There's so much to learn around how to do research well, and how to do it efficiently, before kind of just diving into to writing up some questions and asking some folks, what their experience is like. So I would recommend, investing, if you're going to invest in the tool, invest time and resources into, building up your knowledge base around how to do user research well.
Okay. And going back to that subject that we started talking about, bias, what are the biases that will be introduced by using this type of AI tools?
I don't think there are like an inherent set of biases that, that come with using certain AI tools. I think there are like a plethora of biases that are that exist, right? Mm-hmm. I think using AI tools can be, it can make it easier to be less intentional or kind of like put the thought that you need into like, you know, your scoping and why are we designing certain questions and conversations in the way that we are designing them. I've even seen tools that moderate for you and kind of will run the conversation. So with the tools that we've seen on the market, I think the idea, right, is to be more efficient and to save time. And so with the use of AI tools, we're seeing people take a step back from conducting the research and designing the research and strategizing around how research is used in order to save time and be able to scale, right? Which I completely understand. And also research is still a high touch sport. So when you talk about bias and you talk about different opportunities or different risks that come with using AI, I think that's one of the biggest ones is research is designed to be pretty hands-on, strategizing around the insights that come through and even formulating the insights based on the opportunities that we have as an organization, very high touch. And so asking AI to lead that process, I think is really dangerous. But I also just think it's not as, you're not going to get as much value out of it if you're kind of replacing the wrong things with machine learning.
So we have been talking about how AI brings new biases, but also how it can mitigate other biases, such as the self-referential design that we talked at the beginning. How do you feel that this AI can actually mitigate that personal preferences that we put in the analysis of UX research?
So like I mentioned before, I think AI can be really helpful in examining patterns and surfacing them. And so in when you look at a research study, you know, and you're moderating interviews or looking across multiple or you're moderating usability tests or surveys or things like that, AI can be really helpful in surfacing patterns that maybe we're missing and maybe we're not seeing. Also, when we talk about user segmentation, if there are patterns or trends that we're seeing specifically within a segment, I think it can be really helpful to pick apart that nuance and those pieces for us, especially as people are spread really thin. So if we're balancing multiple projects and like there are things that there's higher potential to miss, maybe it's because it's within a segment that's not our main one, or within a segment or insights that we're less familiar with. I think AI can be really helpful in kind of minimizing the bias around blind spots or tunnel vision.
Okay. So we have established that definitely AI is part of our present in UX research. But looking forward, what are some areas within the UX research that you believe that will evolve significantly in the next few years?
Yeah. So my hope is that in the next few years, we see a lot of evolution around research repository technology. When it comes to research insights, I find that at a lot of organizations, learnings and insights move through people. Right. People will ask, like, do you know anything about this? And do you have any evidence to kind of support where we're taking this and the direction that we're taking design in? Or is there anything that can help steer us into where we're going? And as researchers, we don't want to be bottlenecks ever. We don't want to slow down the like movement of information. And so what I'm hoping to see in the next couple of years is to have repositories that people feel comfortable and are intuitive for people to interact with, right? Mm-hmm. And so if there was a bot or AI tool around surfacing insights that were there or navigating our existing knowledge base of research in a really easy way, I think that would be a game changer.
Okay, interesting. Well, Aniela, that would be all for today. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us and sharing this time with UserLinks. I hope that everyone has learned a lot as much as I did, because I am a UX researcher and I have learned so much in this brief conversation that we had. But yeah, thanks again for everything that you've shared with us today.
So thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
Thank you.